Take a network break, steep a nice hot cup of tea, visualize the perfect virtual donut, and join us as we slash and burn our way through dense thickets of tech news, press releases, and marketing blogs. I'm your host, Drew Conry Murray, and joining me as always is my co-pontificator, Greg Farrow. Greg, how's it going?
I'm just putting away my flamethrower. This week wasn't just a slash and burn, or some weeks it's like hunting for a flower when there's no flowers in the garden. This week it's a flamethrower of news.
Yes, this week is machetes and napalm. All right. Well, before we jump into the news, I want to thank today's sponsor. This episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. You can enhance your technology aptitude with IT Pro TV. It's the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. Thanks, IT Pro TV, for being a sponsor. Jumping into the news, Meraki, which is a Cisco division best known for its cloud-managed wireless LAN, they announced some new products recently, including a 24-port cloud-managed switch and a new access point. What I thought was most interesting, companies also announcing its first-ever voice-over IP phone. You only need to plug it into a network that has the internet to get it up and running. As Meraki notes in its blog announcing the phone, where's the PBX? There is no PBX. Control for calls and features are all provided from and established the Meraki cloud.
Not surprising, Cisco's been pushing a product called HCS, which has hosted collaboration services, to its resellers for years. Over the years, I've been working with companies, and basically, if you think of Cisco's call manager problem, scale it up to a cloud-hosted platform. I haven't been very successful in convincing people because of the price. It's been much cheaper for people to just use smart. You know, it's not a lay-down misère in terms of a, you know, getting a business model off the ground. So I would guess that Meraki's using Cisco's collaboration platform, the hosted collaboration system, and offering it on a per-phone basis to see if anybody's foolish enough to actually put phones on desks.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because we talk a lot about how phones, you know, it's all going mobile, so how many people are actually still buying desk phones?
I think there's a lot of people. People feel like a desk wouldn't be complete without a phone. There's a certain, like, there's a segment of the entire world where a phone on a desk is a status symbol or imaginary or not, if you know what I'm saying. And one of the interesting things about this, of course, is if this is just a case of plugging it in to a line with an internet connection, then all of those people who say QoS is absolutely required to make voice calls must be turning in their graves. They must be feeling very uncomfortable in the pants region right about now. This is hardly surprising. What is surprising, of course, is that it is a division of Cisco that's doing it. If you think about a switch, you could actually run an entire call manager app or a PABX app on the switch. And as long as it's got some Meraki magic behind it, which allows you to say, here's your licenses, we can automate the licenses, we can automate the call setups and teardowns, and also we can hold the gateway to the physical addresses. They can do all that in the cloud, you know, so when you come off IP and you want to get to a mobile, or you want to go to a landline that's running on an ISDN or a T1 line or a SIP gateway, they just do all that in the cloud. They take away all the hard parts. You don't have to ring up Verizon or BT or Telstra and say, please bring me in a T1 and plug it into a PABX and peel off the 24 or 30, 64K lines and attach dialing. All that stuff just goes away. But, you know, it just works over the internet. So the trick, of course, is you need lots and lots of internet bandwidth.
That's right. That's right. Well, Meraki in its blog did make a point of the fact that you can get public telephone numbers for this without having to necessarily go through your service provider. They've got it all pre-worked out ahead of time in the cloud. You just go up there and start assigning numbers.
They'll have a big SIP gateway somewhere, which is connected to a whole bunch of telco backbones and legacy. So when you call a landline of some sort, yeah, the call will go off the internet and into the landline network, and, of course, vice versa. And that's pretty much – people have been connecting up SIP gateways for quite some time, and this is just a cloud version. This whole product isn't new as such. It's just the fact that this is Meraki announcing this product. So we wanted to share the product announcement with you, less the fact that this is a technology you might not have heard of.
Right. And I thought it was interesting because we had talked last week about how Cisco wanting to move toward more subscription-based model, and it seems like the Meraki business unit is one of the units really pushing the Cisco battleship or aircraft carrier in that direction.
So Cisco's revenue is dropping, which is as you'd expect as products, because you're not getting all the revenue in day one. You sell $1 million worth of switches, you get the revenue right now. If you sell something at $100,000 a year, you've got 10 years to make that $1 million, if you like. So Cisco's conducting a balancing act between those two, and this is one of those things. You know, it's not exactly going to replace the big end call manager, IP telephony collaboration stuff that's going on, but this is going to get reach into some of the smaller companies for resellers who sell are very Cisco focused.
Yeah, that's right. Moving on, we always like to keep an eye on containers. So the latest container news is a startup called Rancher Labs, which I had not heard of. They make a container management platform. They've just gotten a $20 million funding round. It's their second round. And according to a story in Information Week, Rancher Labs focuses solely on Docker containers. And so it supports both Kubernetes and Docker Swarm. Those are orchestration platforms. And Charlie Babcock at Information Week says that the reason Rancher Labs is getting some traction is because it's supporting both of these platforms, making them easy to use for customers.
How many more Docker products can we have? Like, haven't we reached peak Docker yet? Like peak containers?
Apparently not.
It's all one thing to be very excited about containers and to see them as the future. It's quite another thing to think that they're coming anytime in the next 5 to 10 years. It's a bit like SDN. We're 5 years into SDN. How's that going?
Slow.
Slow, right? And containers are going to be the same. You have to develop your app from the ground up for containers to work. So realistically, there's a lot more hype around this stuff. Now, that also said, these companies have to be first movers, the first mover advantage. Kubernetes is open source, it's free, it's defining a standard. If you're going to come along and sit on top of Kubernetes, you're going to need to do something pretty amazing to try and displace people just using Kubernetes directly, I think.
Well, I'm sure their play is to add some value to make it a little bit easier to use and consume, maybe put some other functions and features around it, package it up nicely. And that's, you know, a fairly well-established business model to take an open source product and you know, put some support and other goodies around it. I think you're right that people are trying to stake out some market here. And the question is, are they too early? They're definitely not too late. The question is, are you too early?
If you're using Mesosphere or Cloud Foundry, do you really need to orchestrate those when those tools are actually orchestration tools themselves?
Right. That's the question.
So there's, you know, there's so many
Where's
layers.
Where's the value?
Yeah, that's right. And you also, that's an incredibly niche. You're now saying, I've got a product which manages other people's products, yet those products actually haven't been widely accepted in the market yet. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% sure that we're ready for that. That might be just way too early.
Right. Well, it's a little $20 million bet.
On the whole, my sense of that would be is that that's the sound of the toilet flushing. We should have sound button, you know, say goodbye to that one. It'll turn into something else probably as time goes by.
We do need a little bit more like morning DJ radio sound effects. That would be great.
I used to have them, but the app that did them stopped working. It wasn't under development anymore. It was like a big soundboard, and you pressed a button, and it would inject noise. People hated it, but then I couldn't resist playing with it. That was why we done
it. Maybe something to play with as we get closer to the summer.
Yeah, maybe. I'll have a look, see what I can get going. I've got all the tools. I could make it happen, but
Well, let's see what Twitter says about this idea. Okay, so we had talked about Google versus Oracle. There was a big court case about fair use around some Java APIs that Google put into Android. Oracle's crying foul. A San Francisco jury has ruled in Google's favor, saying that its use of the APIs falls under fair use and is not an infringement on the intellectual property of Oracle. So everybody can sigh of relief. It's good for Google, probably good for the industry at large. However, Oracle says it's going to appeal the case, so I think we can probably expect to hear more about this going forward.
I've read several articles about this, about, you know, is it all over Red Rover, or has Oracle got a case to be made? And Oracle's almost certainly going to appeal, because Oracle has got a long history of being litigious about hammering the courts for any sort of slight that it feels is worth doing. But in this case, you know, they've been slapped down pretty hard. The debate has been going backwards and forwards, and you can't find too many people who sit on Oracle's side in this one, not outside the court nor inside the court. And for a jury of non-technical people, albeit in San Francisco, the jury came down, there was no equivocation. It was just, you know, it's not a breach. So I don't think it's going to get up too long, really.
Well, we'll see, because I think the reason this case happened is because Oracle actually won an initial judgment in court saying that, yes, this was an infringement. So It's sort of right now one-to-one, and well, there's going to be a higher court that comes in and makes the decision.
The initial judgment says, is this worth taking up the court's time? It's not, and the answer is yes, we will put this on the docket because it's not a frivolous case. That's how I understand the first phase. Mm-hmm. But this phase is no, there's nothing to fight on with. But you know, let's face it, Larry Ellison's got a fairly substantial ego. He owns the majority of the company, and he's going to pull a Peter Thiel and bash up people because money talks.
And he's got the money to blow.
Yeah, that's right. Got nothing, and he's certainly extorting enough of the people who own Oracle. That's for sure.
That's right. Subsidizing lots of lawyers out there.
I had another wine. Somebody this week was telling me that Oracle did an audit of their licensing and they got nailed. Mm. Their whole IT budget's been ruined for years. And it's funny, Oracle's all about the cloud. And every time they do a license audit, it just drives customers away to the cloud because they don't want to have anything to do with Oracle. I think they need to stop what they're doing. Think carefully about the long-term impacts.
That's right.
But then again, maybe they don't imagine there are any long-term impacts. Maybe there is no long-term for Oracle.
You know? Maybe, I don't know. Well, so you probably remember the showdown between Apple and the U.S. government over unlocking an iPhone that belonged to a gunman who murdered 14 people in San Bernardino, California. We've got a story in Reuters saying that Apple is hiring John Calas. You may know him. He's an encryption expert. He founded the PGP Corporation. The company didn't really provide details around what Calas is going to be working on, but to me it's an indication that Apple isn't backing away from its plans to make encryption stronger and better. And this is actually the third time that Calas has worked for Apple. He worked with the company back in the 90s and in the mid-2000s.
So this is – obviously Apple is doubling down on its encryption, you know, strategy, and hiring people helps them to do that, and also hiring well-known public figures puts them on the map, people who've done PGP Corp are quite familiar with the legal environments where the U.S. government has made previous attempts to shut people down. Mm-hmm. That could be very useful in terms of leading an encryption initiative. Also note that this week there's quite a few hoo-hahs about what Google's doing. Last week it did its conference and it released a chat app or a messaging app, whatever you want to call it, and it's not encrypted and it's not safe and it's not secured. So not only is the data at rest held by Google and therefore vulnerable to Google things, the actual way they chose to do the encryption leaves it open for governments to hack it open, or hackers for that matter. So there's a real gap between what Google's talking about, you know, we're all about safety and, you know, preventing malware and stuff, and what they're doing. So this is kind of like highlighting the gap. And then also in Chrome this week, they removed a feature. I can't remember the exact details, but they removed a feature which was a certain type of security which was better. And they've decided not to proceed with that for now, and they're falling back to something called ALPN. Google's kind of opting for, you know, we'll just roll over and give away people's data because that's what we're doing anyway. So why not? And I think it just highlights the two different approaches to what to customers that Apple and Google are having.
I hadn't heard that, but it does seem, you know, at first glance that's Google saying, yeah, all right, we don't want to fight this fight. We'll just
Facebook's the same. You know, privacy is optional. Encrypting data doesn't actually improve. You know, we're going to give the data away anyway, so why would you keep it encrypted?
Right.
It's one of those the reality is, you know, you can perceive the fact that making the communication between me and the mothership, but it's what happens to the data after that matters.
That's right. You know? Well, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor, IT Pro TV. Greg, you want to tell us what IT Pro TV can do for our listeners?
IT Pro TV helps you with important tools needed for knowledge. In a recent magazine article that I wrote for the Human Infrastructure newsletter, I talked about the idea of comprehensivists, that is that full stack engineers. How do you become comprehensively knowledgeable? How do you learn more than what you know today? And IT Pro TV is one of those ways that you can do that. They've got over 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video. Courses are streamed live as they produce new shows every single week, and you can play them back on your mobile device of choice, in effect on just about any video player. Thank you to the internets. Course topics are things like CompTIA, advanced security practices, CCMP security, ethical hacking, crypto, Metasploit, all that sort of stuff. And one low monthly subscription price with a no-hassle cancellation policy. And maybe you could even think about a corporate subscription. You could get your boss to cough up for the entire organization and people can get access to a fairly complete library of content.
So if you want to find out more, check out itpro.tv/networkbreak to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 a year, but they have a special offer. You can try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code NETWORKBREAK30 to check out their courses, the live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account, so that's less than $40 a month or $399 for the entire year, and you can find links to itpro.tv in the show notes that accompany this podcast. Moving on, Avaya, which is owned by the private equity firm Silver Lake Partners and TPG Capital, it's said to be considering selling the telco equipment company with a price somewhere between $6 and $10 billion. And according to Reuters, Avaya has currently got about $6 billion in debt.
Yeah. The story goes Avaya was taken private a few years ago. It's been held by private ownership for quite some time. And the private equity people might have decided that it's time to put it on the market. The story is that they've hired some bankers to see if a sale is viable in the current market environment. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see. What does that mean? I think if you're a customer of Avaya, you'll want to slow down a little bit while you wait to see what happens. As these companies tend to go through these selling things and buying things, people's attention inside the company tend to waver and move around a little bit. And you might find product lines slip and things like that. And if they do go into a full-on sale, they'll want to make the company look as healthy as possible, and you might see some layoffs or some reductions in products or things like that. Mm-hmm. So watch out for the warning signs that Avaya is actually on the chopping block, because as companies go through sale processes, they tend to impact customers in negative ways.
And I'm curious, who out there do they think is going to buy Avaya or a piece of Avaya?
I think they're talking about a few different companies could be willing to buy it. I don't know if there's anybody in specifically. Maybe there's a Chinese company who wants to get into the market.
I could see that.
Would be, you know, we've already seen H3C's have initiative there. We saw Alcatel-Lucent Enterprise transition into Chinese ownership with Xinhua Corporation 6 months to a year ago. People might look at Brocade, but I don't think so. I think that Avaya's main portfolio is around its IP communications platform as well as its carrier stuff. And that's all fairly focused on history, not so much, doesn't seem to have a dynamic possibility going forward. So if there's a big loyal customer base, maybe somebody like Juniper or Brocade could pick them up. But I think at the price tag of $6 billion with $4 billion of debt, that's a pretty bitter pill to swallow for most of the networking companies that are out there right now anyway.
That's right, yeah.
You know, could you pull out $10 billion worth of value from the Avaya customer base? That's a hard question to answer, I think. You know, could you take those customers and turn them into your own customers? You know, you need both the customers and the products and the revenue to all fire to get a $10 billion price tag. So $6 billion plus $4 billion worth of bad debt.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll keep an eye on this and see where it goes. Mm. Greg, you and I often complain about the cable industry here in the United States. So there's a startup out there called Starry that's working on a gigabit wireless broadband to compete with providers in the home internet access market against folks like Comcast and Verizon. And instead of having to run fiber to every home, customer would just put up a small antenna like in a windowsill and connect to a local transmitter. So there's a story in Technology Review about this startup saying that the issue here is low capital costs could help it actually compete against providers. The founder of the company says it costs him about $25 per customer to set up in an urban area versus thousands of dollars for a typical provider to pull fiber.
Yeah, so for cabling is expensive, astonishingly expensive, and you need 20 years to get your money back usually. You know, 10 years to get your cost back and then 10 years to make a profit out of it. The way that if you can stop running cable and start using wireless, and we know the success of wireless is astonishing because of smartphones again, the way that this works is it uses very, very high frequency radio spectrum between 37 gigahertz and 40 gigahertz. And then they're doing some really, really fancy wireless stuff called active phase arrays, where they're actually actively modifying the antennas and the signal pulsing on the different bands. And so this means that they are actually getting vast amounts of data on this. So it's a different way of approaching a problem. It's in an unlicensed frequency because it's so high frequency. And they're saying they're currently measuring 300 megabits per second to more than 1 gigabit a second at a range of 1 to 1.5 kilometers, even in rain and snow. Now, if that's true, then for cities or high density areas, putting a little antenna out and then pointing it in the general direction of a base station is a highly viable way to bypass digging cable in the ground.
Absolutely.
The challenge, of course, is that what we also know is that when somebody put your antenna out and then somebody puts a building next to you and blocks your line of sight, internet's not actually very reliable. But I doubt that they care much about that. These people, that's where the advantage of fiber, though.
Yes. Yeah, they're definitely pros and cons.
Yes. So the problem with high-frequency radio spectrum like that at 37 gigahertz is it won't go through buildings or glass or anything, actually.
I also thought it was interesting that the founder of this company, folks here in the United States may remember, a little company called Aereo that got into trouble with the FCC because it was essentially they made a device that let you capture TV signals over the air and play them wherever you wanted. And some content providers complained, and so Aereo got shut down. So this guy's back.
The interesting part about Aereo, of course, is that now people just don't watch TV. They just stop watching.
Right.
So all that fighting to keep access to stop TV getting on the internet, and now people just stop watching TV and basically they're watching Netflix because TV is too hard to watch.
That's right.
Yeah.
So you had pulled this out, Greg, from the news. Facebook's launching something called the Telecom Infra Project, and this looks pretty meaty.
Yeah. This is super duper interesting. I missed it a couple of weeks back. It's been on my spike list of things to look at, and I dragged it out this week. Basically, Facebook has assembled a cast of telco providers. Let me just read their announcement. It says, an engineering-focused initiative that is bringing operators, infrastructure providers, system integrators, and other technology companies to collaborate on the development of new technologies and reimagine traditional approaches to building and deploying telecom network infrastructure. So what Facebook is saying is, we've done this thing with the Open Compute Project where we've made low-cost data center infrastructure, and that's been great. But what we want to do now is take those same ideas, same principles, and do it to telecom infrastructure. So reduce the cost of a telecom network. Obviously, Facebook wants more networking because a bigger network, a faster network, means more Facebook that they can give people.
That's right. Right.
So if you could get away from bandwidth caps or volume caps or make the data cheaper, then people will spend more time on Facebook. Good for their business, good for mobile ads. You know, Facebook's making a stonking amount of money in mobile ads. It made $4 billion in mobile ads last quarter, effectively going from zero to $4 billion in less than 3 years, which is astonishing. So it's good for their business. And, you know, let's not highlight Facebook here. Google's doing the same, something similar with gigabit fiber to the home, and it's proved very disruptive in the US. Now Google says, we're going to go into this city. The city council says, oh, great, fantastic, Google, we're going to do Google Fiber. And then all of a sudden Comcast or Verizon or whoever it is suddenly says, oh, we're going to fund a new initiative to put more bandwidth in your town. So Google's proved the model here, and Facebook's doing its part by influencing infrastructure. I feel this is a natural extension to their existing network development process, in that they already showed that they can develop code, they can work with vendors to make custom hardware, and that shakes up the whole environment. Remember the Facebook six-pack and the Facebook Open Compute Project and all those things, cheaper servers, cheaper Ethernet switches, and now they're replacing routing protocols with messaging buses and things like that. I talked about OpenR last week. So this is not a pipe dream. Facebook showed that it can do these things, and the net impact here is that creating cheaper hardware alternatives and software alternatives can reduce the cost of all telco hardware because it creates cheaper options. Now, not every carrier is going to go and buy the cheaper option, but it sure forces the existing vendors to actually compete harder because they have to have a product that's better than free.
Right.
Right. If you're going to pay big money for an existing branded vendor product that looks like a Hermes handbag, it's got to work, it's got to have quality, it's got to have features, and, you know, otherwise people might just as well go and get the low quality, perhaps it's low quality, may or may not be, but the cheaper product that, and just use that. So it's good for everybody. It forces the market to start getting some energy, some speed, some revolution around the products. It's not going to be innovation, it's going to be iteration, and hopefully it can get better. Now, Facebook isn't doing this alone, right? There's a whole bunch of people signed up to this, a whole bunch of big companies signed up to this.
Yeah, it looks like Intel is in there, and then you've got a whole bunch of telecom providers, SK Telecom and others, and Nokia, some big names.
Like all the good foundations. I got a bunch of my buddies together, and we spent some money on a conference in Hawaii or something. But interestingly, things like SK Telecom, which is Singapore Telecom, Nokia, Ericsson, Equinox is in there for an open optical packet transport. And I remember 3 years ago, Equinox was right out there in the front of people of the market saying, we are totally dedicated to closed solutions. We are only going to buy vendor-branded solutions. There's no way we're ever going to buy, merchant silicon. 3 years later, they're all like open optical. They're into open compute. They're into blah, blah, blah. It's really funny, the turnaround.
That's right.
There. Yeah. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that, but I'm not surprised because when a company with Facebook's market-moving power says, this is where we're going, and then suddenly, a bunch of OEMs and ODMs start actually producing stuff and it shakes up the market, people have to pay attention.
Yeah. And those of you who have seen me speak know I talk about the rapid fall in bandwidth pricing on the internet. The interconnect pricing falls at a really rapid rate over the years. And these people have to find ways to produce more bandwidth at a cheaper price, which is really hard, right? How do you deliver more at a lesser price? You can't normally do both at the same time. Mm-hmm. But that's the way it's working right now. And so this is hopeful that it will start to stimulate more creative solutions in the market. Like I was reading an article in Light Reading this week, and they're talking about, you know, AT&T is saying the only things we're going to buy is open and it's going to be white box. And other articles, you know, saying we're embracing ONOS or, you know, all of the open SDN controllers, they're going to be the core of our NFV strategy. Now, whether these people actually action all of those or not, I don't know. It's a little hard to tell. Telcos do a lot of talking and sometimes run for cover when it comes to putting down the money on the table. But, you know, this is seems to get a lot of take-up, so let's see where it goes from here. No predictions on this one, though.
You're not going to venture a prediction here?
No, this is – the telco market is decidedly weird. It can be influenced because it's so small and insular and isolated and bunkered. Like people who work for carriers are often just so bunkered into their mentality. They're so isolated as to what they know and what they learn. They don't get out. They look at enterprise and think there's no lessons to be learned. They look at cloud providers and say that you guys don't know anything about running networks, whether only we know what's best for us. And so it's entirely possible for them just to ignore what's going on around them.
Okay, well, no prediction, but we'll definitely keep an eye on this. You also had a story about CSC announcing a merger with the enterprise services segment of Hewlett-Packard Enterprises, and they're trying to put together a global IT services giant.
Yeah. So professional services is hard. I think I've said that before, haven't I?
I think so.
Yeah, more than once, I think.
Well, we do a weekly show, so you're allowed to repeat yourself.
The professional services is super hard to do, and particularly outsourcing seems to have been very hard hit by the recent sort of switch to cloud, because why would I outsource something to an outsourcing company when I can just go and give it away to the cloud, move it into the cloud and keep control of it? I mean, mm-hmm. And you know, you can argue very many things about it, but that's how I see it anyway. And so the idea that outsourcing is going to be a way of the future is very much under threat. And as I've said before, the Indian outsourcers are also seeing shrinking revenues, like rapidly shrinking revenues, as people stop outsourcing, because in the era of DevOps and convergence and hyperconverged platforms, it's a whole lot easier just to go and buy, you know, a Nutanix or a VBlock or something like that, put it in your data center, and guess what? You don't need a team of 30 people like you did 5 years ago. You just need a couple of people and move on. So things are changing, I think, and this is a recognition of the fact that HPE doesn't want to own its services, professional services arm. It spent about 5 years going out to customers and taking whole of IT contracts, so taking, you know, data center management, IT ops, network ops, the whole bit, and the supply and the operation and committing to the whole thing. And now, of course, that's a massive burden in the modern era. These people, these customers are saying, well, how can we change? And they're saying, I've got a contract and I'm going to supply you this, and it's still got 5 years to run, and their customers hate them. So there's no way to win, right?
Right.
So this is going to be great. So HPE estimates a transaction will be worth $8.5 billion to shareholders, with $4.5 billion delivered as an equity stake in the new company. I did read some competitive analysis here where somebody pointed out is that CSC, which is fundamentally the major part of the merger, is saying it will get $1.5 billion in synergies, in other words, in cost savings from a synergies. If you think that today CSC is a $5 billion company and HPE is an $8.5 billion company, to cut $1.5 billion out, that's an awful lot. That's like 10 to 20% of money just pulled out of the bottom line.
That's – wow. And yeah. My guess would be that most of that is going to come through attrition, layoffs.
Well, it's got to come from somewhere. They could be just making it up to make themselves look good, and the market seemed to believe them. The share prices have absolutely popped. HP is up like 10% on the back of this, 11%, and CSC is up 34%. In the aftermath of that. Maybe some once people get to poke at the details and think a little bit more carefully about how hard it is to make money out of professional services, they'll be a little bit less excited. But CSC, you know, it's the old story, get big or go home, get big or get out. And so that's what they're doing. It's another Dell EMC-type merger, except this time it's just professional services and outsourcing contracts.
It's been a while since I've seen the word synergy. I kind of fell out of favor.
Yeah, we got overused.
Good thing. Really. Yeah, we don't stop meaning anything.
Synergistic, synergism. It was just endless for a while there.
That's right.
Maybe we should
welcome back, Synergy.
I don't know. No, maybe we should put that on the banned list.
That's right. What do you think? Happy to.
Happy, like innovation. Innovation.
All right, our next story, Viptela, an SD-WAN company, they have announced a $75 million Series C round of financing. Wow, that's pretty good.
So Viptela is a longtime sponsor of the show, so a bit of disclosure. But this is actually what I think is interesting here is this round of financing values them at nearly $1 billion. Mm. So just imagine that, an SD-WAN company going from zero about, I think it was about 4 years ago it was founded, and now it's nearly $1 billion in valuation. That's almost at the point where Cisco will be interested in buying it.
Right.
So Cisco ACI was $1 billion when it was 800 million when it was spun back in. So Viptela's at that sort of size on its current valuation. So I just wanted to flag that up and say that, you know, this SD-WAN thing is getting money still being poured into it, even though there's a substantial pullback in VC funding.
Yeah, definitely a white-hot market, lots of interest, and I don't see it cooling off anytime soon. I'm still waiting for an acquisition or two to come down the road.
I think it's hard. Like, you know, it's too early for Cisco and Juniper to go and buy SD-WAN companies because it undermines their existing product portfolios.
Right. That's why I'm not thinking it's those two that I was thinking. I'm trying to think about this morning. I was going with HP because I don't think they have, you know, a real branch router story that, you know, SD-WAN story would necessarily endanger an internal product line.
Well, they sure did. There's the HPE. They do have a big Comware portfolio. But with Comware going back into H3C ownership, it is possible that HP could buy them. Maybe HP could buy Avaya. And get a network division again. Like H3C is for China, the Chinese market, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, doing a whole portfolio for the HPE has basically been building. There's a Chinese version of HPE. It's 51% owned by the Chinese government, and there's a portfolio of products that go there. And for the rest of the world, there's a different line. So maybe that's where it could go.
Yeah, why not?
Probably not with $4 billion worth of debt.
No. All right, this is our final story. It's about the IETF. You found this. You regular listeners will know your feelings about standards bodies, but what's going on with the IETF here?
Let me just read you the article. This is from Circle ID. It was written by a person who used to be the head of the IETF's governing body for a while. So I'll read you this verbatim, and then we can just talk about this. And I want to be sensitive to the political and the personal aspects and the societal aspects of this one. So the IETF is considering canceling its 100th meeting, currently scheduled in Singapore, at a cost of $80,000 because concerns were raised about anti-LGBT laws. The controversy is now playing out on censored IETF lists, and at least one party is making it through the IETF list gatekeepers appointed. Basically, the IETF is scheduled to go to Singapore. There are people playing politics with the IETF process and saying because Singapore is opposed to lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people, they shouldn't have a meeting in Singapore. Mm. Now, the IETF is barely doing anything right, in my opinion. It's struggling to be relevant. It's struggling to maintain. If people are going to hijack debates for political outcomes like this, that's not good for the IETF. On the other hand, I'm very sensitive to the fact that society needs to move forward and people should be able to say, you know, these are the ways that things change. I'm sort of torn between two sides of the debate here. What about you?
I'm going to come down on the side of being in favor of the IETF doing this. I think economics speaks very powerfully when you deny business to an area because of practices that are, you know, in my opinion, reprehensible, denying folks their basic human rights. Yeah, absolutely. Step out. I don't have a problem with it.
Singapore's a beautiful place. I've been there several times and I actually quite like Singapore. They've got a number of quite weird laws, like chewing gum is illegal in Singapore. Mm. You're not allowed to have long hair, like men can't have long hair over the collar. There's a whole bunch of laws like this to do with good behavior and the way you're expected to act. How about that? Mm-hmm. Would that chase you away?
You know, so there are cultural norms that are, you know, just a sort of cultural norm without really – doesn't necessarily have to have a moral component. It's just sort of a custom. And then there are norms that, you know, violate your a sense of ethics and human rights. And I'd say when you're talking about things that violate people's human rights, people's what's fair and right, then yes, that's when you make a stink.
Now maybe the ITF shouldn't be in the US because there's quite strong anti-LGBT sentiment throughout that, and in a lot of places there's actually laws. So we shouldn't be in the US either, perhaps.
Well, they would be very welcome in California. They'd be very welcome in Massachusetts. There are states that are, you know, there's places like North Carolina that are having fights about this, but there's plenty of room in the United States for pro-LGBT. So.
So what else can the ITF object to? What about prisoners of conscience?
I understand.
What about China? I mean, the ITF goes to China and has meetings. There's, you know.
You're absolutely right.
Where does this stop? The problem here is, where does this stop? The organization may not be able to function if you take this too. I'm playing devil's advocate here, but.
Absolutely. No, you know, it's fine.
Where does this stop? If you start to take this sort of stuff into your thing, you end up going down a rabbit hole from which there's no end.
Yes, I can see how you would do that, but I can understand the concern about an endless black hole of political causes, but I think there are some political causes that rise to the level of, yes, we can feel justified in taking a stand here. I mean, every organization is going to have to decide for itself, you know, where it draws the line in terms of a political message that it wants to send, but I think this is a valid one.
It's a difficult one. I'm not going to fall on either side of this fence. I'm inclined to
say. I guess I feel like to say we can never take any stand because we'll have to take every stand is kind of a specious argument.
My sense is you've already said you're going, so go and just say you won't go back again unless things change, right? You've already forked out the money. You've told people you're coming. People have committed time and energy and calendar scheduling and stuff like that. I think it's ridiculous to turn around and suddenly say because, you know, some do-gooder wants to be overly sensitive, but just say, right, well, this will be the last time we'll go to Singapore. We'll look for other sources next time.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to disagree with you.
Mm. So, you know, in some ways
it makes more of a stand when you say we've already sunk some money in here. We're pulling out, though, because we feel strongly about this, that it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, but the ITF isn't about politics. It's just nerds.
Right. Nerds can have politics too.
I'm they're just people doing whatever it is they want to do. I'm not sure why I care one way or the other about them, to be fair. I do understand, you know, that we need to take away the stigma, but on the other hand, it's like, whatever, just move on. Anyway, no answers, I don't think. I just wanted to flag that one up, how community-driven initiatives can be derailed by pointless activities, and they can actually kill them.
I don't think this is going to kill the ITF, though.
It can do. It can lead to a lot of disenfranchised people who exit. This type of stuff will cause that.
Well, we'll see. And we, you know, if you want, folks who are listening want to weigh in, you know, hit us up on Twitter. You can leave a comment in the show notes. I think this is something worth discussing. But Greg and I, we've said our piece, so we should probably just wrap it up there.
Yeah, that's it. Moving on.
All right. So that does bring us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, if folks want to hear more from you, where can they find it?
You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitter is at etherealmind.
And I'm Drew Conroy-Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net and I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. Thanks to our sponsor, IT Pro TV. Please check them out on our website. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, please give us a like on Facebook or leave a recommendation on iTunes or share it with your friends. And you can also check out our newsletters, the Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. And all of that information is at packetpushers.net. Thank you for listening.